I'm here on a job site with Tim, who owns his own electrical contracting business.
3 employees and 2 work trucks.
Tim traded up to Geico Commercial Auto Insurance. We're positively here where he needs us most.
They sure are.
With step-by-step help on all his insurance needs, all for shockingly low rates.
Shockingly low, huh?
Just a little bit of electrician humour. Do you get it?
I got it.
You know, it feels like we have a real connection. All right, I'll stop.
Get a commercial auto insurance quote today at geico.com and see how much you could save. It feels good to Geico.
You're listening to a podcast right now. Driving, working out, walking the dog. If you're into podcasts, chances are you have something to say too. With RSS.com, starting your own is free and easy. Upload an episode and we distribute it to Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Amazon Music, and hundreds more. Track your listeners, see where they're from, and start earning from ads like this, even with just 10 listeners a month. If you've been thinking about starting a podcast, this is your sign. Start free at rss.com.
This topic of the search for extraterrestrial life ranges widely, and it can spin off in a lot of crazy directions. If you listened to the interview with Joe Scott, you heard us talk about the rare Earth hypothesis. For this bonus episode of Wild Thing, astrophysicist Neil deGrasse Tyson shares a different take on the same idea. We also talk about the difficulties we humans have in grasping the enormity of the universe and spend a little time on movie aliens. I imagine most of you know who Neil deGrasse Tyson is, but for those who don't, he's the director of the Hayden Planetarium at the American Museum of Natural History in New York. And he's done a tremendous job of making astrophysics, astronomy, and science more accessible to the general public. I start by asking him how he got hooked on astronomy.
I think the immensity of it and the endless ignorance that it contained. I enjoyed the prospect of participating in advancing a frontier that exists between what we know or what we think we know of the universe and where we have yet to step or to observe or to visit. And I felt that way since I was 9 years old. So I've been at this my entire life.
Yeah. And the immensity is an interesting point because for me, I find that very daunting. Like, you know, you're on this ball of mud that is hurtling around.
There's some iron in there, too.
Yeah, there's some iron.
It's not all mud.
It's zipping around this flaming ball of hydrogen.
There's some rocks, too.
Some rocks. All right, fine. You're so picky. But, you know, we're whirling around this flaming ball of hydrogen in a solar system that's just one of many, in a galaxy that's one of many. I mean, this is enormous. And you start thinking about there's other galaxies out there. And then beyond that, we could be galaxies within galaxies within galaxies. It's like Russian nesting dolls. How do you come to terms with that? Because to me, it's just like overwhelming and I want to crawl back into my little shell.
Well, apparently, most people don't come to terms with it. I think perhaps they fear the uncertainty of it or the loneliness of it when you contemplate the vastness of it all. Mm-hmm. And so historically, religion has provided a very powerful and potent resource for people to feel comfortable with those boundaries between where you are and the unknown, mm-hmm. but between life and death, between Earth and not Earth, between the beginning and the end. So I think it's harder to become a scientist if you must have answers to every question you pose to yourself. People who are deeply religious are more content with what leaves others uncomfortable about the unknown because they have answers for it. And that they don't spend their life anguishing over the answers to those questions. Or if they do, then they're religious and they become scientists, which is more than half of all scientists in the West would claim strong adherence to a religion. In the West, it would be Christianity primarily. So to be religious and to be a scientist is not itself mutually exclusive. But you have to draw some lines, all right? You're not going to say, this is happening because God did it, now I'm done. You're going to say, this is happening, I don't know why, let me go find out. So the curiosity manifested in your activities is really what matters between whether you're a scientist or anything else.
Yeah.
You mentioned something at the very beginning of that. You talked about loneliness. Are we alone? Do you think we're alone?
It's not likely. If you just look at the numbers and if you analyze it, you look at how old the universe is, how big the universe is, you look at what we're made of, the ingredients, and you find these ingredients everywhere in the universe. Some of the ingredients landed here in meteorites. They're amino acids, building blocks of proteins that show up in meteorites that fall from the sky. And so when you add all this up, you say to yourself, it would be extraordinary if Earth were the only place in the universe that contained life. It would be so extraordinary as to be like, you'd wonder what's going on. Like, how is this even possible? So anyone who has studied the problem, even in the absence of affirmative data to say there is life, will tell you that it's highly likely that there's life out there. It's just a matter of time before we find it.
Yeah. So would you say that then that's probably the most compelling argument for extraterrestrial life is the fact that the universe is so big and these elements that are precursors to life that help build life are not that rare?
Yeah, they're not only not that rare, they're the most common ingredients in the universe. So I'm making a stronger statement than that. In addition, life got underway on Earth almost as soon as it possibly could have. So if you sort of look at when Earth started getting slammed by leftover material in the solar system. So the term used for that is accretion. So there's Earth and then there's still leftover material. This still accumulates on Earth, makes for a very hostile surface. When most of that gets swept up, then the surface begins to cool. And when you have a cooler surface, you can make larger molecules that are stable. When you get big molecules, there tend to be places where they break apart if there's energy introduced to it. And so energy like a colliding asteroid, high temperatures, this sort of thing, stress to the system. So when Earth calmed down, start your clock. How long after that did we have the first evidence of life on Earth? It was about 100 million years. Now, it sounds like a long time, but compared to the 4.5 billion years that Earth has been around, the fact that 100 million years ago, dinosaurs were roaming the Earth. So 100 million years is nothing. So if here we are in an undistinguished star, in an undistinguished galaxy, in an undistinguished corner of the universe, generating life within 100 million years, for you to suggest that Earth is rare, probably if we part the curtains, you will have other philosophical reasons for requiring that you believe it's to be so. Often it's a religious reason that Earth is the special point of creation in the whole universe. So usually there's something else driving it, and it's not the data itself.
So you are not a rare Earths person by any stretch of the imagination.
So rare Earth, that whole concept, is adding up factors that by the end of your argument, you're saying we're special. Now, just let's back up for a minute. We've been launching the we're special argument ever since we've had consciousness, right? Mm-hmm. We want to, and it's natural. Not only we're special as a species, but you're special as an individual. Just look at how much energy we invest in boosting that emotional state within us. We say, oh, we are, you know, look at the centuries of thinking that we are at the top of some evolutionary tree of life, right? As though we are some pinnacle of evolution. Well, everything else that's alive today is just as far away from the origins of life as we are. So, and by the way, eagles can fly. You can't fly. Oh, you needed an engineer to build a vessel that you walk into that can then fly. Okay. So I always wonder, do birds pity us because we can't fly? Do fish pity us because we can't swim? Do we don't have gills? I always try to invert the perspective because then you think differently about your own life. I found some video of dogs yapping at each other, like angry, like arguing about something. And I tweeted it with a caption, I wonder if this is what advanced aliens see when they watch humans having an argument. This is what we look like to them. just yapping with no. And we're saying that with the dogs, we say, oh, they're just yapping. But if you're the dog, do you know whether, you know, advanced thoughts are being exchanged? You don't really know. You're going to assume there isn't, and that helps you distinguish yourself from the dog. So if you want to distinguish Earth from all other planets in the universe, you should ask yourself, what's motivating you? Mm-hmm. Is it because you want to end the conversation?
You're listening to a podcast right now. Driving, working out, walking the dog. If you're into podcasts, chances are you have something to say too. With RSS.com, starting your own is free and easy. Upload an episode and we distribute it to Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Amazon Music, and hundreds more. Track your listeners, see where they're from, and start earning from ads like this, even with just 10 listeners a month. If you've been thinking about starting a podcast, this is your sign. Start free at RSS.com.
By saying we're unique in the galaxy, if not the entire universe, you should watch out for your biases as a scientist. So watch what happens. You'll say, okay, so Earth has just the right amount of pressure in the atmosphere so that water is retained as liquid. If the pressure were too low, the water would evaporate. If the pressure were too high, you might have a runaway greenhouse. You go through this and you end up with what you are saying is a perfect place. Well, we evolved in this place. So, of course, everything we say about it is going to say it's as though it was designed just for us. It's like the polar bear saying, isn't the world great? The water is 33 degrees. That's wonderful. I have this fur. Everything is designed perfectly for me. The seals come up and they make a tasty meal and I'm bigger than they are. So what a beautiful world. And nowhere is the hubristic polar bear saying, I evolved to exploit these conditions so that they can serve my survival. By the way, most life that has ever existed on Earth is now extinct. So if you want to think of Earth as some haven for life, you have to factor in that most life Earth wants to kill and has succeeded in doing so. So the rare Earth hypothesis is actually not about life in general. It's about what we call intelligent life, complex life, because that takes a little longer. It's one thing to be alive and just eat and reproduce. To now have a brain to think beyond that, to think about tomorrow, to think about your past. So their argument is planets of the kind that could have intelligent life, complex life, those would be rare. And I agree, they'd be rarer than planets that had mats of microbes thriving on them, as Earth was for most of its history. Just right. Mats of single-celled organism for billions of years. So if you threw a dart at the timeline of Earth, most of the time, you're not getting complex life. But when complex life did take root, oh my gosh, it was, you had the Cambrian explosion of life. Consider we went from dinosaurs to humans in 65 million years. Ask yourself what fraction of the total history of Earth that represents. Mammals barely had a foothold 65 million years ago when the dinosaurs went extinct. And now the largest animal there ever was is alive today. And it's a mammal, okay, the whales of the ocean. Mm-hmm. So people tend to underestimate the power of natural selection in finding solutions that exploit an environment that would be hostile to other life forms.
What do you think the implications of finding life would be for us here on Earth? Assuming it were to happen, let's say it happens in the next 10 years, what do you think the reaction would be?
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know whether it would signal a change in the human condition that we cannot foresee or imagine. But I can say that if we find just simple life that a single-celled life or life that undergoes photosynthesis, it could revolutionize biology. Mm-hmm. The real question and the real challenge is if we find life or if life finds us, that is unmistakably smarter than we are. Then will they just make us their pets Will they, you know, that's in fact, that's the stuffing of science fiction films, that they love stuff like, they love it. If you want to know what it would be like to be the pet of an entity of superior intelligence, okay, just ask yourself, what are the things you do with your pets to get them to obey you? Okay. You tantalize them with a treat because you know they want the treat. This is how you teach them to sit down or to roll over or to bay. All right. Then they get a treat. We train them for our own amusement. Okay. Less so with cats. This is why people think that really cats are our overlords. And so we like thinking we're at the top of the heap, or that we'll go searching for intelligent life in the universe and then we'll find it and have a conversation with it. For all we know, we will look like yapping chihuahuas to this species of intelligent aliens. And the hubris to even imagine that we'd be able to communicate with another, quote, intelligent species. So if you start thinking along those lines, it can be quite humbling when you put ourselves in the context of the history of life on Earth, what the future of life on Earth could be, and what especially could be the future or the current existence of intelligent life in the universe.
Yeah. I don't want to be someone's pet. Maybe we shouldn't go looking after all.
Well, if you don't want to be someone's pet, but you happily have other animals as pets. I mean, think this through.
I have cats.
No cats.
And maybe I am someone's pet. So I talked to a number of the SETI scientists, including a woman named Natalie Cabrol, and she was talking to me about quantum physics. And she put out this line that consciousness is the universe becoming aware of itself. Life is a force and not a thing. And these are I have trouble wrapping my head around these ideas. But, you know, what do those phrases mean to you?
I don't think we really understand consciousness enough to then invoke it to explain something else. So I think that's always dangerous. Here's this thing. Oh, people believe we understand consciousness and they – what are we doing? We're writing books on it, okay? Go to the bookshelf in the bookstore. There's a whole shelf full of books on consciousness explained, the inside consciousness. The fact that we're still writing books on it is evidence that we don't understand it, okay? It's the opposite of what you think. It's because people still think, oh, I need another book on this. Go look for books on the physics of gravity. There's like 3 books on the shelf. That's it. We're not still writing books on it because we got this, okay? We can do a hole-in-one landing in a crater on Mars from Earth. We got this. Okay. So I'm never comfortable taking something we don't know well and invoking it to account for other things we know even less well. So you can say consciousness is the universe's way of getting to know itself. Well, if humans have what you want to call consciousness, and let's say it's rare, if not unique, then the universe was really inefficient at making that happen. All right. If the universe took 4.5 billion years to create something with consciousness that could then perform experiments to figure out how the universe works, this doesn't sound like a purposeful experiment. It sounds like a really badly designed experiment. Inefficient. What the hell are you doing? You could have figured yourself out long ago, but you didn't. What's going on?
Huh. Yeah. Okay, let's talk a little bit more about microbial life. If you were a betting man and you had money to burn, where would you put your money on when and where we're going to find microbial life?
I would say in the oceans of Europa.
Really?
One of the moons of Jupiter, right? And I joke, if you find life there, what would you call it? And of course, you'd have to call it Europeans, right? Because it's Europa.
They're going to be upset.
So I put my money there. I'd also put it in the subsurface soils of Mars.
Okay.
Mars was once wet with running water, and you know the water was there for a while because they're dried riverbeds, and the riverbeds have meandered. Mm-hmm. That means you have a slow-moving water to do that. Okay, that doesn't happen when you have fast-moving streams, and it takes time for a river to meander. So I think if there's not life living there today, we might find evidence of there once having been life there. So we have to get down deep, and on Mars and Europa, those. And by the way, if there's no life there, I think I'd be sad. I'd be disappointed. I'd be disappointed. It's like,
yeah,
you know, two good shots where they had water, they've got heat sources, this sort of thing.
Yeah.
And if there is life there and the two neighboring planets, neighboring places, then that blows open the lid for life being elsewhere that we could find.
That would be so exciting. And the cool thing about it is it could very well.
You're listening to a podcast right now, driving, working out, walking the dog. If you're into podcasts, chances are you have something to say too. With RSS.com, starting your own podcast is free and easy. Upload an episode and we distribute it to Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Amazon Music, and more. Track your listeners, see where they're from, and start earning from ads just like this. If you've been thinking about starting a podcast, this is your sign. Start your new podcast for free today at RSS.com.
Happened in our lifetime.
Yep.
Okay, let's go back to aliens.
Space aliens with technology. That kind of alien.
Yeah, let's go there for a minute.
Like movie aliens. That's what you're talking about.
Okay. Yeah. I'm just curious because you said you were starting to become interested in astronomy at the age of the very young age of 9. Did aliens enter into that at all? Was this something that interested you?
Oh, I love alien movies, but no.
Okay. Which was your favorite alien movie?
The Blob.
Oh, really? I just watched that recently.
Did you?
I did. Okay, it's quite a flick.
It's quite a flick. It was Steve McQueen. I think it was his first film.
Uh-huh.
So here's the thing with The Blob. Notice it had no face.
Right.
It had no legs or arms or eyes or
mouth.
And so it was completely creative. Think about it. A face, eyes, nose, mouth is a very vertebrate thing to have. If you are not a vertebrate creature in this world, you have none of the above. All right. Where's the eyes, nose, teeth, and mouth, and shoulders, and arms, and fingers of a jellyfish?
Well, spiders have faces.
Okay. All right. I'll give you a face on a spider. Sure. Faces of their of a sort. Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. But the kind of faces we tend to put on aliens, those are vertebrate faces. Okay. Mm-hmm. From ET, even to the Predator, to you just go down the list of all of the most famous aliens. They're lizard-looking aliens, you know, but they all have faces. And so if only one branch of animals, okay, one branch of the tree of life, the vertebrate branch, has faces, and all the rest don't, and you're going to go to another planet that might not even be based on DNA and generate life forms that have faces, this is just not creative. This is embarrassing, okay? And so I know you have to pay an actor who's wearing a suit, so I get that. But don't tell me you're being creative by just giving your alien pointy ears, okay?
Oh, Spock.
That's not shocking for what an alien could be. They need to look at least as different from us as other life forms on Earth look from each other if it's coming from another planet. The Blob was such a creature. So I applaud The Blob for what it was as an alien creature. It defied all our physiology and our biology.
Did you see Annihilation?
No. Is it a movie?
Yeah, it's a movie. It came out in 2017, 2018, I think.
Does it begin with people ignoring the advice of scientists?
I mean, isn't that how everything begins now?
Everything begins. Every movie where bad stuff happens.
Not even the movies, just life.
Right.
Speaking of scientists, so one of the themes of this season of the podcast deals with Oumuamua and exploring this question of just what exactly it was, you know, comet, alien light sail. And I sat down and talked with Avi Loeb over at Harvard, and he's the one who put forward the hypothesis about it being a light sail, mainly, as I understand it, because he wanted people to consider all the possibilities, including that of extraterrestrial life. What was your response to the Oumuamua reaction?
I was not among those who said this could be aliens. It is true. It could be aliens, but what you want to be honest about the probabilities of this. And what you do is you make a list of things that could be going on. So first, we've been looking for interstellar interlopers ever since we've had the capacity to do so, and we hadn't found any. Most of them are just really long period comets. So it's easy. You can instantaneously know whether the thing is visiting us from another star system just by its velocity and its trajectory as it hooks around the sun. So that's not a difficult task to achieve scientifically. When you do this, if you find out it came out, okay, so now how is it moving? It turned out Oumuamua, its trajectory was not following precisely what you'd expect it to do by just the gravity of the sun and the other planets. And so it was a bit of a mystery. So here you go. You say, is this mystery solved by saying these are intelligent aliens guiding a spacecraft? Or is there something else we have yet to consider because we don't have much data on interstellar spacecraft, on interstellar objects? We don't have much data. So this is all new. So let's see what are the properties of such an object, okay? And when you do this and you make a list, could it be this, could it be that, or could it be something we haven't thought about yet? The history of this exercise is one where it is hardly ever the most extraordinary explanation. It is so hardly ever that if you ever even put it on the list of things it could be, then you're betraying a bias that has me worry about what else you're thinking about as explanations for things we don't understand. Just because we don't understand something doesn't mean aliens did it. Just because you don't know how the Egyptians built the pyramids doesn't mean aliens helped them. Just because there are lights in the sky you cannot explain doesn't mean it's aliens. It is not a logical conclusion to land there. Yeah, put it on the list. But if that becomes the main thing you're talking about, then you're not honest about the history of science and what scientific investigation has revealed. Now, for me, if you want to say, is it anywhere on the list? Yeah, it's really low on the list. So low, I'm going to spend my professional life exhausting the other options before I even consider it. By the way, mm-hmm. If you read his original research paper, it's like 1.5 sentences at the end of right. A very long paper analyzing possibilities of what it could be. And then he says, oh, by the way, we shouldn't rule out that it could be a navigated craft. And it's like, okay. But now, of course, the press makes a big thing of it. Plus, he writes blogs that focuses on it. So he helped attention go to that paragraph. But I, like I said, I'm not in that camp. Mm-hmm.
So I'm guessing you're also not in the camp of aliens have visited Earth and kidnapped our cows.
And eviscerated them, right. If those are aliens, I'm surprised at how shy they are and how they have defied high-resolution photography among the billions of photos uplifted to the internet every day. Where's the footage of the aliens walking towards you? And you can stream it live so the aliens don't zap it. I just need better evidence, that's all. Maybe it's all aliens. I just wonder why they're so shy.
So in the 1990s, Senator Richard Bryant from Nevada successfully had funding for the search for extraterrestrial intelligence cut out of the budget. Given how much the technology has changed, how much more we can see, how many more worlds we think might be habitable, should that money be included again in NASA's budget? Should they be allowed to go searching for intelligent extraterrestrial life? Or is that better left to private enterprise like with Yuri Milner's breakthrough initiatives?
Okay, you have to ask, what is it worth to you to know whether or not there's intelligent life in the universe beyond Earth? What's that worth you? Out of a budget dollar, mm-hmm. Would you put in one penny? Let's say every year, April 15th, you had a pie chart and you say, oh, this much for defense, this much for healthcare, this much for roads, whatever. And you divide it up and it asks you, how much of this, is that number zero for people? Mm-hmm. I'm thinking no, I'm thinking there's some amount of money you might want to put there. Is it a tenth of a penny out of your tax dollar? Whatever that is, that would be fulfilling a quest that people have deep within them. For a senator to cut the money, it requires more than just one senator. People have to vote to cut it. So it means he's influencing other senators or other members of Congress. If that senator is actually representing their district, their state, and is actually representing their districts, and the district says, I don't want to spend money on things, then they're doing what they're duly elected to do. That's what, you know, a republic, democratic republic, is supposed to do. So fine. For me, discovery on any frontier historically has had extraordinary impact on the future of civilization. Occasionally negative, by the way, but usually positive when in the hands of wise and benevolent leaders. By the way, around that time, I testified in Congress. I was asked to give comment on the value of the search for extraterrestrial intelligence. So I just simply described the value of knowing relative to not knowing. And do you really know the value to biology, to physics, to engineering, if we search for life and find it? If they know more about certain things than we do, how we could benefit from it? If the government goes out of the funding of science business, then it would have to go to private enterprise, but then private enterprise would have to find a way to make money on it.
Yeah.
Otherwise, it won't get done at all. And without governments doing research that don't have immediate economic impact, you would have no basic research happening whatsoever. There'd be a little bit, but provided it had obvious connectivity to the bottom line of the quarterly report of the business. Okay, so this is what R&D is all about. The R&D is still aligned to the product, whereas pure R&D is not aligned to any product at all. It's just the curiosity of the researcher and the moving of a frontier that has unknowns on the other side without reference to whether it could you can make a product at the end of it. And I can tell you this, that by some estimates, a third of the total world's GDP derives from the creation, storage, and retrieval of digital information. That would not be possible were it not for our ability to exploit quantum physics. And quantum physics was discovered fundamentally in the 1920s. If you're running around the 1920s, are you going to say, we have to cut this funding? What, you're just studying an atom? No, you can't even see an atom. They're too small for anyone to care about. What do you? Why are you doing this? This is a waste of money. My God, particularly 1929 comes around, the stock market crashes and everybody's broke. You're on an unemployment line and you're saying you're wasting your brilliance on studying an atom that nobody can see, but we have people hungry on the line. Yeah, it would take 50 years before it began to matter. But you cannot imagine life today without digital. Life today is inconceivable without its digital footprint. And so I'm just saying that to research a frontier, the fact that we had a member of Congress cut it, judging that it was a waste of money, means there's a missing educational link that started way before that person became a member of Congress. So I can't go around beating people on the head for what they think or don't think as adults. I can tell you that curiosity is something we're all born with, and we lose it by middle school, and maybe for some as late as high school. For those that retain it, they become scientists because everything about them is, I don't understand this, I want to figure it out. Because scientists and engineers, they want to figure it out. And it's a precious few who retain this level of curiosity. That member of Congress did not.
Yeah. So when you're talking about value, I mean, this kind of gets back to what we were talking about a little bit earlier with why you got into this field some ways to begin with, because of this fascination, because of like the value of learning and of not knowing and wanting to know.
Yeah, I didn't use the word value, but I just say, because that implies money, it implies... It's an aspect of when people use the word value. What's the value of that research? It has no value to anything going on right now in the world today. None whatsoever. But in 10 years, it might. In 50 years, it certainly will. Okay, that's how I can describe that. For me, just as a kid, I enjoyed the not knowing. Mm-hmm. That's all. Like, we can say I valued it, sure. Okay, but I enjoyed that. The immensity of the ignorance. And I thought maybe one day I'd be able to help advance that frontier of knowledge.
Does this idea sort of fit into what you talk about as the overview effect? Because I've seen you mention this recently on Twitter and in some of the conversations, including on your own podcast. This idea that it's something bigger than us that should ostensibly make us think less about our own crap down here on Earth.
Is that the best word you come up with in that moment?
That was not very poetic at all.
I know you're way more literate than that. You want a roll there for a second. The overview effect more specifically references what astronauts have felt after coming back from orbit. Mm-hmm. I would more broadly, I would say the overview effect is a subset of what I will call the cosmic perspective. And that's something that I and all of my colleagues carry, my astrophysics colleagues. And it's just, looking at Earth adds to it, but looking at other galaxies, looking at the size and scale of the universe, all of this contributes. And what it does is it doesn't have to make you feel small. It can make you feel large, realizing that you're part of the great unfolding of cosmic events in this universe that began 14 billion years ago. I feel large when I think about that. When you have the cosmic perspective, you go back to things that you had invested so much emotional energy tribalizing, and you take a step back and say, no, there's only one tribe and we're all human. And when you do that, the differences become quite petty. Mm-hmm. And so it's been said many times, the first time we get a big bus to go into space, just send all the politicians up there. some people want to leave a few of them up there, but don't bring them back. But in any case, they would all come back with an overview effect, a cosmic perspective that could completely transform their egos or their sense of the world and how we're all in this together rather than being all in it separately.
Mm-hmm. Why do you think it's important to have a person like Carl Sagan or like yourself representing these concepts, astrophysics, science to the masses?
Yeah, I'm not going to tell you what you think should be important. I'm just not going to do that. What I will say is the role of science and technology in the survival of civilization has never been greater. If you live in a democracy where you are a participant in decisions that affect laws and legislation and the future of civilization, and you want to be an informed participant, then you might want to become more scientifically literate. All right, it's an if-then. If you don't care, I'm not going to try to make you care. But if you do care about your health, your wealth, your security, the health and wealth security of your offspring, their offspring, the seven generation down, if you care about them, then you care about creating a world and leaving them a world that they'll be proud of. What do you want subsequent generations to think of you? That's all. So I think it matters. It matters if you want to be an active participant in shaping the future of civilization or become a better shepherd of civilization than we have been in the past decades.
That was astrophysicist Neil deGrasse Tyson, the director of the Hayden Planetarium at the American Museum of Natural History. For more astronomy insights, you can watch him on the TV as he hosts the third season of Cosmos, listen to his podcast, Star Talk, or follow him on Twitter, at Neil Tyson. You can follow us, too, at Wild Thing Pod. And for more about Wild Thing, check out our website, wildthingpodcast.com. This podcast is a production of Foxtopus, Inc. Our executive producer is Scott Carney. Editing is by Alicia Lipinski. And the score and sound mixing come from Louis Weeks. I'm your host and creator, Laura Krantz.
You're listening to a podcast right now. Driving, working out, walking the dog. If you're into podcasts, chances are you have something to say too. With RSS.com, starting your own podcast is free and easy. Upload an episode and we distribute it to Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Amazon Music, and more. Track your listeners, see where they're from, and start earning from ads just like this. If you've been thinking about starting a podcast, this is your sign. Start your new podcast for free today at rss.com.